And Carl, the little prick, he's so goddamn selfish. I'm an egotist, but I'm not selfish. There's a difference. I'm a neurotic, I guess. I can't stop thinking about myself. It isn't that I think myself so important. I simply can't think about anything else, that's all. If I could fall in love with a woman, that might help some. But I can't find a woman who interests me. I'm in a mess. You can see that, can't you? What do you advise me to do? What would you do in my place? Listen, I don't want to hold you back any longer, but wake me up tomorrow at 1:30, will you? I'll give you something extra if you'll shine my shoes. And listen, if you've got an extra shirt, a clean one, bring it along, will you? Shit, I'm grinding my balls off on that job, and it doesn't even give me a clean shirt. They've got us over here like a bunch of niggers. Ah, well, shit. I'm gonna take a walk. Wash the dirt out of my belly. Don't forget, tomorrow. For 6 months or more, it's been going on. This correspondence with the rich cunt, Irene. Recently, I've been reporting to Carl every day in order to bring the affair to a head. Because as far as Irene is concerned, this thing could go on indefinitely. In the last few days, there's been a perfect avalanche of letters exchanged. The last letter we dispatched was almost 40 pages long and written in three languages. It was a potpourri, the last letter. Tag ends of old novels, slices from the Sunday supplement, reconstructed versions of old letters to Lona and Tanya, garbled transliterations of Rabelais and Petronius. In short, we exhausted ourselves. Finally, Irene decides to come out of her shell. Finally, a letter arrives giving a rendezvous at her hotel. Carl is pissing in his pants. It's one thing to write letters to a woman you don't know. It's another thing entirely to call on her and make love to her. At the last moment, he's quaking so that I almost fear I'll have to substitute for him. When we get out of the taxi in front of her hotel, he's trembling so much that I have to walk him around the block first. He's already had two Pernod, but they haven't made the slightest impression on him. The sight of the hotel itself is enough to crush him. It's a pretentious place with one of those huge, empty lobbies in which English women sit for hours with a blank look. In order to make sure that he wouldn't run away, I stood by while the porter telephoned to announce him. Irene was there. She was waiting for him. As he got into the lift, he threw me a last, despairing glance. One of those mute appeals which a dog makes when you put a noose around its neck. Going through the revolving door, I thought of Van Norden. I go back to the hotel and wait for a telephone call. He's only got an hour's time, and he's promised to let me know the results before going to work. I look over the carbons of the letters we sent her. I try to imagine the situation as it actually is, but it's beyond me. Her letters are much better than ours. They're sincere, that's plain. By now, they've sized each other up. I wonder if he's still pissing in his pants. The telephone rings. His voice sounds queer, squeaky, as though he were frightened and jubilant at the same time. He asks me to substitute for him at the office.
Tell the bastard anything. Tell him I'm dying.
Listen, Carl, can you tell me? Hello? Are you Henry Miller? It's a woman's voice. It's Irene. She's saying hello to me. Her voice sounds beautiful over the phone. Beautiful. For a moment, I'm in a perfect panic. I don't know what to say to her. I'd like to say, listen, Irene, I think you're beautiful. I think you're wonderful. I'd like to say one true thing to her, no matter how silly it would sound, because now that I hear her voice, everything has changed. But before I can gather my wits, Carl is on the phone again, and he's saying in that queer, squeaky voice,
she likes you, Joe. I told her all about you.
At the office, I have to hold copy for Van Norden. When it comes time for the break, he pulls me aside. He looks glum and ravaged.
So he's dying, is he, the little prick? Listen, what's the lowdown on this?
I think he went to see his rich cunt, I answer calmly.
What? You mean he called on her? He seems beside himself. Listen, where does she live? What's her name?
I pretend ignorance.
Listen, he says, you're a decent guy. Why the hell don't you let me in on this racket?
In order to appease him, I promise finally that I'll tell him everything as soon as I get the details from Carl. I can hardly wait myself until I see Carl. Around noon next day, I knock at his door. He's up already and lathering his beard. Can't tell a thing from the expression on his face. Can't even tell whether he's going to tell me the truth. The sun is streaming in through the open window. The birds are chirping. And yet somehow, why it is, I don't know, the room seems more barren and poverty-stricken than ever. The floor is slathered with lather, and on the rack there are the two dirty towels which are never changed. And somehow, Carl isn't changed either, and that puzzles me more than anything. This morning, the whole world ought to be changed, for bad or good, but changed, radically changed. And yet, Carl is standing there, lathering his face, and not a single detail is altered.
"Sit down. Sit down there on the bed," he says. "You're going to hear everything. But wait first. Wait a little."
He commences to lather his face again, and then to hone his razor. He even remarks about the water. No hot water again.
"Listen, Carl, I'm on tenterhooks. You can torture me afterward if you like, but tell me now, tell me one thing. Was it good or bad?"
He turns away from the mirror with brush in hand and gives me a strange smile.
"Wait, I'm going to tell you everything."
"That means it was a failure."
"No,"
he says, drawing out his words.
"It wasn't a failure, and it wasn't a success either. By the way, did you fix it up for me at the office? What did you tell them?"
I see it's no use trying to pull it out of him. When he gets good and ready, he'll tell me, not before. I lie back on the bed, silent as a clam. He goes on shaving. Suddenly, apropos of nothing at all, he begins to talk. Disconnectedly at first, and then more and more clearly, emphatically, resolutely. It's a struggle to get it out, but he seems determined to relate everything. He acts as if he were getting something off his conscience. He even reminds me of the look he gave me as he was going up the elevator shaft. He dwells on that lingeringly, as though to imply that everything were contained in that last moment. As though, if he had the power to alter things, he would never have put foot outside the elevator. She was in her dressing sack when he called. There was a bucket of champagne on the dresser. The room was rather dark, and her voice was lovely. He gives me all the details about the room. The champagne, how the garçon opened it, the noise it made, the way her dressing sack rustled when she came forward to greet him. He tells me everything but what I want to hear. It was about 8 when he called on her. At 8:30, he was nervous, thinking about the job.
"It was about 9 when I called you, wasn't it?"
he says. "Yes, about that."
"I was nervous, see? I know that. Go on."
I don't know whether to believe him or not, especially after those letters we concocted. I don't even know whether I've heard him accurately, because what he's telling me sounds utterly fantastic. And yet, it sounds true, too, knowing the sort of guy he is. And then I remember his voice over the telephone, that strange mixture of fright and jubilation. But why isn't he more jubilant now? He keeps smiling all the time, smiling like a rosy little bedbug that has had its fill.
"It was 9 o'clock, he says once again, "when I called you up, wasn't it?"
I nod my head wearily. Yes, it was 9 o'clock. He is certain now that it was 9 o'clock because he remembers having taken out his watch. Anyway, when he looked at his watch again, it was 10 o'clock. At 10 o'clock, she was lying on the divan with her boobies in her hands. That's the way he gives it to me, in driblets. At 11 o'clock, it was all settled. They were going to run away, to Borneo. Fuck the husband. She never loved him anyway. She would never have written the first letter if the husband wasn't old and passionless.
And then she says to me, "But listen, dear, how do you know you won't get tired of me?"
At this, I burst out laughing. This sounds preposterous to me. I can't help it. "And you said?"
"What did you expect me to say?" I said, "How could anyone ever grow tired of you?"
And then he describes to me what happened after that. How he bent down and kissed her breasts, and how, after he had kissed them fervidly, he stuffed them back into her corsage, or whatever it is they call those things. And after that, another coupe of champagne. Around midnight, the garçon arrives with beer and sandwiches. Caviar sandwiches. And all the while, so he says, he has been dying to take a leak. He had one hard on, but it faded out. All the while, his bladder is fit to burst. But he imagines, the cute little prick that he is, that the situation calls for delicacy. At 1:30, she's for hiring a carriage and driving through the bois. He has only one thought in his head, how to take a leak. "I love you. I adore you," he says. "I'll go anywhere you say, Istanbul, Singapore, Honolulu. Only I must go now. It's getting late." He tells me all this in his dirty little room, with the sun pouring in and the birds chirping away like mad. I don't yet know whether she was beautiful or not. He doesn't know himself, the imbecile. He rather thinks she wasn't. The room was dark, and then there was the champagne, and his nerves all frazzled. "But you ought to know something about her, if this isn't all a goddamn lie." "Wait a minute," he says. "Wait. Let me think." "No, she wasn't beautiful. I'm sure of that now. She had a streak of gray hair over her forehead. I remember that. But that wouldn't be so bad. I'd almost forgotten it, you see. No, it was her arms. They were thin. They were thin and brittle." He begins to pace back and forth. Suddenly, he stops dead. "If she were only 10 years younger," he exclaims. "If she were 10 years younger, I might overlook the streak of gray hair and even the brittle arms. But she's too old. You see, with a cunt like that, every year counts now. She won't be just 1 year older next year. She'll be 10 years older. Another year hence, and she'll be 20 years older. And I'll be getting younger looking all the time, at least for another 5 years. But how did it end?" I interrupt. "That's just it. It didn't end. I promised to see her Tuesday around 5 o'clock. That's bad, you know. There were lines in her face which will look much worse in daylight. I suppose she wants me to fuck her Tuesday. Fucking in the daytime. You don't do it with a cunt like that. Especially in a hotel like that. I'd rather do it on my night off. But Tuesday's not my night off. And that's not all. I promised her a letter in the meantime. How am I going to write her a letter now? I haven't anything to say. Shit. If only she were 10 years younger. You think I should go with her? To Borneo or wherever it is she wants to take me? What would I do with a rich cunt like that on my hands? I don't know how to shoot. I'm afraid of guns and all that sort of thing. Besides, she'll be wanting me to fuck her night and day. Nothing but hunting and fucking all the time. I can't do it." "Maybe it won't be so bad as you think. She'll buy you a tie and all sorts of things. Maybe you'll come along with us, eh? I told her all about you." "Did you tell her I was poor? Did you tell her I needed things?"
"I told her everything. Shit, everything would be fine if she were just a few years younger. She said she was turning 40. That means 50 or 60. It's like fucking your own mother. You can't do it. It's impossible."
"But she must have had some attractiveness. You were kissing her breasts, you said."
"Kissing her breasts? What's that? Besides, it was dark, I'm telling you."
Putting on his pants, a button falls off.
"Look at that, will you? It's falling apart, the goddamn suit. I've worn it for 7 years now. I never paid for it either. It was a good suit once, but it stinks now. And that cunt would buy me suits, too. All I wanted, most likely. But that's what I don't like, having a woman shell out for me. I never did that in my life. That's your idea. I'd rather live alone. Shit, this is a good room, isn't it? What's wrong with it? It's a damn sight better than her room, isn't it? I don't like her fine hotel. I'm against hotels like that. I told her so. She said she didn't care where she lived. Said she'd come and live with me if I wanted her to. Can you picture her moving in here with her big trunks and her hat boxes and all that crap she drags around with her? She has too many things, too many dresses and bottles and all that. It's like a clinic, her room. If she gets a little scratch on her finger, it's serious. And then she has to be massaged, and her hair has to be waved, and she mustn't eat this, and she mustn't eat that. Listen, Joe, she'd be all right if she were just a little younger. And you can forgive a young cunt anything. A young cunt doesn't have to have any brains. They're better without brains. But an old cunt, even if she's brilliant, even if she's the most charming woman in the world, nothing makes any difference. A young cunt is an investment. An old cunt is a dead loss. All they can do for you is buy you things. But that doesn't put meat on their arms or juice between the legs. She isn't bad, Irene. In fact, I think you'd like her. With you, it's different. You don't have to fuck her. You can afford to like her. Maybe you wouldn't like all those dresses and the bottles and whatnot, but you could be tolerant. She wouldn't bore you, that I can tell you. She's even interesting, I might say. But she's withered. Her breasts are all right yet, but her arms. I told her I'd bring you around someday. I talked a lot about you. I didn't know what to say to her. Maybe you'd like her, especially when she's dressed. I don't know. Listen. She's rich, you say. I'll like her. I don't care how old she is, so long as she's not a hag. She's not a hag. What are you talking about? She's charming, I tell you. She talks well. She looks well, too. Only her arms. All right. If that's how it is, I'll fuck her. If you don't want to. Tell her that. Be subtle about it, though. With a woman like that, you've got to do things slowly. You bring me round and let things work out for themselves. Praise the shit out of me. Act jealous-like. Shit, maybe we'll fuck her together, and we'll go places, and we'll eat together, and we'll drive and hunt and wear nice things. If she wants to go to Borneo, let her take us along. I don't know how to shoot either, but that doesn't matter. He doesn't care about that either. She just wants to be fucked, that's all. You're talking about her arms all the time. You don't have to look at her arms all the time, do you? Look at the bedspread. Look at the mirror. Do you call this living? Do you want to go on being delicate and live like a louse all your life? You can't even pay your hotel bill. And you've got a job, too. This is no way to live. I don't care if she's 70 years old. It's better than this. Listen, Joe, you fuck her for me. Then everything will be fine. Maybe I'll fuck her once in a while, too. On my night off. It's 4 days now since I've had a good shit. There's something sticking to me like grapes. You've got the piles, that's what. My hair is falling out, too, and I ought to see a dentist. I feel as though I were falling apart. I told her what a good guy you are. You'll do things for me, eh? You're not too delicate, eh? If we go to Borneo, I won't have hemorrhoids anymore. Maybe I'll develop something else, something worse. Fever, maybe, or cholera. Shit, it's better to die of a good disease like that than to piss your life away on a newspaper with grapes up your ass and buttons falling off your pants. I'd like to be rich, even if it were only for a week, and then go to a hospital with a good disease, a fatal one, and have flowers in the room and nurses dancing around and telegrams coming. They take good care of you if you're rich. They wash you with cotton batting and they comb your hair for you. Shit, I know all that. Maybe I'd be lucky and not die at all. Maybe I'd be crippled all my life. Maybe I'd be paralyzed and have to sit in a wheelchair. But then I'd be taken care of just the same, even if I had no more money. If you're an invalid, a real one, they don't let you starve. And you get a clean bed to lie in. And they change the towels every day. This way, nobody gives a fuck about you, especially if you have a job. They think a man should be happy if he's got a job. What would you rather do? Be a cripple all your life or have a job? Or marry a rich cunt? You'd marry a rich cunt, I can see that. You only think about food. But supposing you married her and then you couldn't get a hard-on anymore. That happens sometimes. What would you do then? You'd be at her mercy. You'd have to eat out of her hand like a little poodle dog. You'd like that, would you? Or maybe you don't think of those things. I think of everything. I think of the suits I'd pick out and the places I'd like to go, but I also think of the other thing. That's the important thing. What good are the fancy ties and the fine suits if you can't get a hard-on anymore? You couldn't even betray her because she'd be on your heels all the time. No, the best thing would be to marry her and then get a disease right away. Only not syphilis. Cholera, let's say, or yellow fever. So that if a miracle did happen and your life was spared, you'd be a cripple for the rest of your days. Then you wouldn't have to worry about fucking her anymore. And you wouldn't have to worry about the rent either. She'd probably buy you a fine wheelchair with rubber tires and all sorts of levers and whatnot. You might even be able to use your hands. I mean, enough to be able to write. Or you could have a secretary for that matter. That's it. That's the best solution for a writer. What does a guy want with his arms and legs? He doesn't need arms and legs to write with. He needs security, peace, protection. All those heroes who parade in wheelchairs. It's too bad they're not writers. If you could only be sure, when you go to war, that you'd have only your legs blown off. If you could be sure of that, I'd say, let's have a war tomorrow. I wouldn't give a fuck about the medals. They could keep the medals. All I'd want is a good wheelchair and 3 meals a day. Then I'd give them something to read, those pricks.
The following day, at 1:30, I call on Van Norden. It's his day off, or rather his night off. He has left word with Carl that I am to help him move today. I find him in a state of unusual depression. He hasn't slept a wink all night, he tells me. There's something on his mind, something that's eating him up. It isn't long before I discover what it is. He's been waiting impatiently for me to arrive in order to spill it.
That guy, he begins, meaning Carl, that guy's an artist. He described every detail minutely. He told it to me with such accuracy that I know it's all a goddamn lie. But I can't dismiss it from my mind. You know how my mind works.
He interrupts himself to inquire if Carl has told me the whole story. There isn't the least suspicion in his mind that Carl may have told me one thing and him another. He seems to think that the story was invented expressly to torture him. He doesn't seem to mind so much that it's a fabrication. It's the images, as he says, which Carl left in his mind that get him. The images are real, even if the whole story is false. And besides, the fact that there actually is a rich cunt on the scene, and that Carl actually paid her a visit, that's undeniable. What actually happened is secondary. He takes it for granted that Carl put the boots to her. But what drives him desperate is the thought that what Carl has described to him might have been possible. It's just like that guy, he says, to tell me he put it to her 6 or 7 times. I know that's a lot of shit, and I don't mind that so much. But when he tells me that she hired a carriage and drove him out to the Bois, and that they used the husband's fur coat for a blanket, that's too much. I suppose he told you about the chauffeur waiting respectfully. And listen, did he tell you how the engine purred all the time? Jesus, he built that up wonderfully. It's just like him to think of a detail like that. It's one of those little details which makes a thing psychologically real. You can't get it out of your head afterward. And he tells it to me so smoothly, so naturally. I wonder, did he think it up in advance, or did it just pop out of his head like that, spontaneously? He's such a cute little liar, you can't walk away from him. It's like he's writing you a letter, one of those flower pots that he makes overnight. I don't understand how a guy can write such letters. I don't get the mentality behind it. It's a form of masturbation. What do you think?
But before I have an opportunity to venture an opinion, or even to laugh in his face, Van Norden goes on with his monologue. Listen, I suppose he told you everything. Did he tell you how he stood on the balcony in the moonlight and kissed her? That sounds banal when you repeat it, but the way that guy describes it, I can just see the little prick standing there with a woman in his arms, and already he's writing another letter to her. Another flower pot about the rooftops and all that crap he steals from his French authors. The guy never says a thing that's original. I found that out. You have to get a clue, like, find out whom he's been reading lately. And it's hard to do that because he's so damn secretive. Listen, if I didn't know that you went there with him, I wouldn't believe that the woman existed. A guy like that could write letters to himself. And yet he's lucky. He's so damn tiny, so frail, so romantic-looking that women fall for him now and then. They sort of adopt him. They feel sorry for him, I guess. And some cunts like to receive flower pots. It makes them feel important. But this woman's an intelligent woman, so he says. You ought to know. You've seen her letters. What do you suppose a woman like that saw in him? I can understand her falling for the letters, but how do you suppose she felt when she saw him? But listen, that's all beside the point. What I'm getting at is the way he tells it to me. You know how he embroiders things. Well, after that scene on the balcony, he gives me that like an hors d'oeuvre, you know. After that, so he says, they went inside, and he unbuttoned her pajamas. What are you smiling for? Was he shitting me about that? No, you're giving it to me exactly as he told me. Go ahead. After that, here Van Norden has to smile himself. After that, mind you, he tells me how she sat in the chair with her legs up, not a stitch on. And he's sitting on the floor, looking up at her, telling her how beautiful she looks. Did he tell you that she looked like a Matisse? Oh, wait a minute. I'd like to remember exactly what he said. He had some cute little phrase there about an odalisque. What the hell's an odalisque, anyway? He said it in French, that's why it's hard to remember the fucking thing. But it sounded good. It sounded like just the sort of thing he might say. And she probably thought it was original with him. I suppose she thinks he's a poet or something. But listen, all this is nothing. I make allowances for his imagination. It's what happened after that that drives me crazy. All night long, I've been tossing about playing with these images he left in my mind. I can't get it out of my head. It sounds so real to me that if it didn't happen, I could strangle the bastard. A guy has no right to invent things like that, or else he's diseased.
End of side 6. Side 7.
What I'm getting at is that moment when he says he got down on his knees, and with those two skinny fingers of his, he spread her cunt open. You remember that? He says she was sitting there with her legs dangling over the arm of the chair, and suddenly, he says, he got an inspiration. This was after he had given her a couple of lays already. After he had made that little spiel about Matisse, he gets down on his knees, get this, and with his two fingers, just the tips of them, mind you, he opens the little petals. Squish, squish. Just like that. A sticky little sound. Almost inaudible. Squish, squish. Jesus, I've been hearing it all night long. And then he says, as if that weren't enough for me, then he tells me he buried his head in her muff. And when he did that, so help me Christ, if she didn't swing her legs around his neck and lock him there, that finished me. Imagine it. Imagine a fine, sensitive woman like that swinging her legs around his neck. There's something poisonous about it. It's so fantastic that it sounds convincing. If he had only told me about the champagne and the ride in the Bois and even that scene on the balcony, I could have dismissed it. But this thing is so incredible that it doesn't sound like a lie anymore. I can't believe that he ever read anything like that anywhere. And I can't see what could have put the idea into his head unless there was some truth in it. With a little prick like that, you know, anything can happen. He may not have fucked her at all, but she may have let him diddle her. You never know with these rich cunts what they might expect you to do.
When he finally pulls himself out of bed and starts to shave, the afternoon is already well advanced. I've finally succeeded in switching his mind to other things, to the moving, principally. The maid comes in to see if he's ready. He's supposed to have vacated the room by noon. He's just in the act of slipping into his trousers. I'm a little surprised that he doesn't excuse himself or turn away. Seeing him standing there nonchalantly buttoning his fly as he gives her orders, I begin to titter.
Don't mind her, he says, throwing her a look of supreme contempt. She's just a big sow. Give her a pinch in the ass, if you like. She won't say anything.
And then, addressing her in English, he says,
come here, you bitch. Put your hand on this.
At this, I can't restrain myself any longer. I burst out laughing, a fit of hysterical laughter which infects the maid also, though she doesn't know what it's all about. The maid commences to take down the pictures and the photographs, mostly of himself, which line the walls.
You, he says, jerking his thumb. Come here. Here's something to remember me by.
Ripping a photograph off the wall.
When I go, you can wipe your ass with it. See, he says, turning to me. She's a dumb bitch. She wouldn't look any more intelligent if I said it in French.
The maid stands there with her mouth open. She is evidently convinced that he is cracked.
Hey, he yells at her as if she was hard of hearing. Hey, you! Yes, you. Like this. And he takes the photograph, his own photograph, and wipes his ass with it. Comme ça, savvy? You've got to draw pictures for her, he says, thrusting his lower lip forward in absolute disgust. He watches her helplessly as she throws his things into the big valises. Here, put these in too, he says, handing her a toothbrush and the douchebag. Half of his belongings are lying on the floor. The valises are crammed full, and there is nowhere to put the paintings and the books and the bottles that are half empty. Sit down a minute, he says. We got plenty of time. We've got to think this thing out. If you hadn't come around, I'd never have gotten out of here. You see how helpless I am? Don't let me forget to take the bulbs out. They belong to me. And that wastebasket belongs to me, too. They expect you to live like pigs, these bastards. The maid has gone downstairs to get some twine. Wait till you see. She'll charge me for the twine, even if it's only 3 sous. They wouldn't sew a button on your pants here without charging for it. The lousy, dirty scroungers. He takes a bottle of Calvados from the mantelpiece and nods to me to grab the other. No use carrying these to the new place. Let's finish them off now. But don't give her a drink. That bastard, I wouldn't leave her a piece of toilet paper. I'd like to ruin the joint before I go. Listen, piss on the floor if you like. I wish I could take a crap in the bureau drawer. He feels so utterly disgusted with himself and everything else that he doesn't know what to do by way of venting his feelings. He walks over to the bed with a bottle in his hand, and pulling back the cover, he sprinkles Calvados over the mattress. Not content with that, he digs his heels into the mattress. Unfortunately, there's no mud on his heels. Finally, he takes the sheet and cleans his shoes with it. That'll give him something to do, he mutters vengefully. Then, taking a good swig, he throws his head back and gargles his throat. And after he's gargled it good and proper, he spits it out on the mirror. There, you cheap bastards! Wipe that off when I go! He walks back and forth mumbling to himself. Seeing his torn socks lying on the floor, he picks them up and tears them to bits. The paintings enrage him, too. He picks one up, a portrait of himself done by some lesbian he knew, and he puts his foot through it. That bitch! You know what she had the nerve to ask me? She asked me to turn over my cunts to her after I was through with them. She never gave me a sou for writing her up. She thought I honestly admired her work. I wouldn't have got that painting out of her if I hadn't promised to fix her up with that cunt from Minnesota. She was nuts about her. Used to follow us around like a dog in heat. We couldn't get rid of the bitch. She bothered the life out of me. I got so that I was almost afraid to bring a cunt up here for fear that she'd bust in on me. I used to creep up here like a burglar and then lock the door behind me as soon as I got inside. She and that Georgia cunt. They drive me nuts. The one is always in heat, and the other is always hungry. I hate fucking a woman who's hungry. It's like you push a feed inside her, and then you push it out again. Jesus, that reminds me of something. Where did I put that blue ointment? That's important. Did you ever have those things? It's worse than having a dose. And I don't know where I got them from either. I've had so many women up here in the last week or so that I've lost track of them. Funny, too, because they all smelled so fresh. But you know how it is. The maid has piled his things up on the sidewalk. The patron looks on with a surly air. When everything has been loaded into the taxi, there is only room for one of us inside. As soon as we commence to roll, Van Norden gets out a newspaper and starts bundling up his pots and pans. In the new place, all cooking is strictly forbidden. By the time we reach our destination, all his luggage has come undone. It wouldn't be quite so embarrassing if the madam had not stuck her head out of the doorway just as we rolled up. My God, she exclaims. What in the devil is all this? What does it mean? Van Norden is so intimidated that he can think of nothing more to say than, c'est moi, madame. And turning to me, he mumbles savagely, that cluck. Did you notice her face? She's going to make it hard for me. The hotel lies back of a dingy passage and forms a rectangle very much in the order of a modern penitentiary. The bureau is large and gloomy, despite the brilliant reflections from the tile walls. There are bird cages hanging in the windows and little enamel signs everywhere, begging the guests in an obsolete language not to do this and not to forget that. It is almost immaculately clean, but absolutely poverty-stricken.
threadbare, woebegone. The upholstered chairs are held together with wired things. They remind one unpleasantly of the electric chair. The room he is going to occupy is on the fifth floor. As we climb the stairs, Van Norden informs me that Maupassant once lived here, and in the same breath remarks that there is a peculiar odor in the hall. On the fifth floor, a few window panes are missing. We stand a moment, gazing at the tenants across the court. It is getting toward dinner time, and people are straggling back to their rooms with that weary, dejected air which comes from earning a living honestly. Most of the windows are wide open. The dingy rooms have the appearance of so many yawning mouths. The occupants of the rooms are yawning too, or else scratching themselves. They move about listlessly, and apparently without much purpose. They might just as well be lunatics. As we turn down the corridor toward room 57, a door suddenly opens in front of us, and an old hag with matted hair and the eyes of a maniac peers out. She startles us so that we stand transfixed. For a full minute, the three of us stand there, powerless to move or even to make an intelligent gesture. Back of the old hag, I can see a kitchen table, and on it lies a baby, all undressed, a puny little brat, no bigger than a plucked chicken. Finally, the old one picks up a slop pail by her side and makes a move forward. We stand aside to let her pass, and as the door closes behind her, the baby lets out a piercing scream. It is room 56, and between 56 and 57 is the toilet where the old hag is emptying her slops. Ever since we have mounted the stairs, Van Norden has kept silence, but his looks are eloquent. When he opens the door of 57, I have for a fleeting moment the sensation of going mad. A huge mirror, covered with green gauze and tipped at an angle of 45 degrees, hangs directly opposite the entrance, over a baby carriage which is filled with books. Van Norden doesn't even crack a smile. Instead, he walks nonchalantly over to the baby carriage and, picking up a book, begins to skim it through, much as a man would enter the public library and go unthinkingly to the rack nearest to hand. And perhaps this would not seem so ludicrous to me if I had not espied at the same time a pair of handlebars resting in the corner. They look so absolutely peaceful and contented, as if they had been dozing there for years, that suddenly it seems to me as if we had been standing in this room, in exactly this position, for an incalculably long time, that it was a pose we had struck in a dream from which we had never emerged, a dream which the least gesture, the wink of an eye even, will shatter. But more remarkable still is the remembrance that suddenly floats up of an actual dream which occurred only the other night, a dream in which I saw Van Norden in just such a corner as is now occupied by the handlebars. Only instead of the handlebars, there was a woman crouching with her legs drawn up. I see him standing over the woman with that alert, eager look in his eyes which comes when he wants something badly. The street in which this is going on is blurred. Only the angle made by the two walls is clear, and the cowering figure of the woman. I can see him going at her in that quick animal way of his, reckless of what's going on about him, determined only to have his way, and a look in his eyes as though to say, "You can kill me afterwards, but just let me get it in. I've got to get it in." And there he is, bent over her, their heads knocking against the wall. He has such a tremendous erection that it's simply impossible to get it in her. Suddenly, with that disgusted air which he knows so well how to summon, he picks himself up and adjusts his clothes. He is about to walk away when suddenly he notices that his penis is lying on the sidewalk. It is about the size of a sawed-off broomstick. He picks it up nonchalantly and slings it under his arm. As he walks off, I notice two huge bulbs, like tulip bulbs, dangling from the end of the broomstick. And I can hear him muttering to himself, "Flower pots, flower pots." The garçon arrives, panting and sweating. Van Norden looks at him uncomprehendingly. The madam now marches in, and walking straight up to Van Norden, she takes the book out of his hand. thrusts it in the baby carriage, and, without saying a word, wheels the baby carriage into the hallway.
"This is a bug house," says Van Norden, smiling distressedly. It is such a faint, indescribable smile, but for a moment, the dream feeling comes back, and it seems to me that we are standing at the end of a long corridor, at the end of which is a corrugated mirror. And down this corridor, swinging his distress like a dingy lantern, Van Norden staggers. Staggers in and out as here and there a door opens and a hand yanks him or a hoof pushes him out. And the further off he wanders, the more lugubrious is his distress. He wears it like a lantern which the cyclists hold between their teeth on a night when the pavement is wet and slippery. In and out of the dingy rooms he wanders, and when he sits down, the chair collapses. When he opens his valise, there is only a toothbrush inside. In every room, there is a mirror before which he stands attentively and chews his rage. And from the constant chewing, from the grumbling and mumbling and the muttering and cursing, his jaws have gotten unhinged, and they sag badly. And when he rubs his beard, pieces of his jaw crumble away. And he's so disgusted with himself that he stamps on his own jaw, grinds it to bits with his big heels. Meanwhile, the luggage is being hauled in, and things begin to look crazier even than before, particularly when he attaches his exerciser to the bedstead and begins his Sandow exercises. "I like this place," he says, smiling at the garçon. He takes his coat and vest off. The garçon is watching him with a puzzled air. He has a valise in one hand and the douchebag in the other. I'm standing apart in the antechamber, holding the mirror with the green gauze. Not a single object seems to possess a practical use. The antechamber itself seems useless, a sort of vestibule to a barn. It is exactly the same sort of sensation which I get when I enter the Comédie Française or the Palais Royal Theatre. It is a world of bric-a-brac, of trapdoors, of arms and busts and waxed floors, of candelabras and men in armor, of statues without eyes and love letters lying in glass cases. Something is going on, but it makes no sense. It's like finishing the half-empty bottle of Calvados because there's no room in the valise. Climbing up the stairs, as I said a moment ago, he had mentioned the fact that Maupassant used to live here. The coincidence seems to have made an impression upon him. He would like to believe that it was in this very room that Maupassant gave birth to some of those gruesome tales on which his reputation rests. "They lived like pigs, those poor bastards," he says. We are sitting at the round table, in a pair of comfortable old armchairs that have been trussed up with thongs and braces. The bed is right beside us, so close indeed that we can put our feet on it. The armoire stands in a corner behind us, also conveniently within reach. Van Norden has emptied his dirty wash on the table. We sit there with our feet buried in his dirty socks and shirts and smoke contentedly. The sordidness of the place seems to have worked a spell on him. He is content here. When I get up to switch on the light, he suggests that we play a game of cards before going out to eat. And so we sit there by the window with the dirty wash strewn over the floor and the Sandow exerciser hanging from the chandelier, and we play a few rounds of two-handed pinochle. Van Norden has put away his pipe and packed a wad of snuff on the underside of his lower lip. Now and then he spits out of the window, big, healthy gobs of brown juice which resound with a smack on the pavement below. He seems content now. "In America," he says, "you wouldn't dream of living in a joint like this. Even when I was on the bum, I slept in better rooms than this. But here, it seems natural. It's like the books you read. If I ever go back there, I'll forget all about this life, just like you forget a bad dream. I'll probably take up the old life again, just where I left off. If I ever get back. Sometimes I lie in bed dreaming about the past, and it's so vivid to me that I have to shake myself in order to realize where I am, especially when I have a woman beside me. A woman can set me off better than anything. That's all I want of them, to forget myself. Sometimes I get so lost in my reveries that I can't remember the name of the cunt or where I picked her up. That's funny, eh? It's good to have a fresh, warm body beside you when you wake up in the morning. It gives you a clean feeling. You get spiritual-like. Until they start pulling that mushy crap about love, etc. Why do all these cunts talk about love so much? Can you tell me that? A good lay isn't enough for them, apparently. They want your soul, too. Now, this word soul, which pops up frequently in Van Norden's soliloquies, used to have a droll effect upon me at first. Whenever I heard the word soul from his lips, I would get hysterical. Somehow it seemed like a false coin, more particularly because it was usually accompanied by a gob of brown juice, which left a trickle down the corner of his mouth. And as I never hesitated to laugh in his face, it happened invariably that when this little word bobbed up, Van Norden would pause, just long enough for me to burst into a cackle. And then, as if nothing had happened, he would resume his monologue, repeating the word more and more frequently, and each time with a more caressing emphasis. It was the soul of him that women were trying to possess, that he made clear to me. He has explained it over and over again, but he comes back to it afresh each time like a paranoiac to his obsession. In a sense, Van Norden is mad, of that I'm convinced. His one fear is to be left alone. And this fear is so deep and so persistent that even when he's on top of a woman, even when he has welded himself to her, he cannot escape the prison which he has created for himself. I try all sorts of things, he explains to me. I even count sometimes, or I begin to think of a problem in philosophy, but it doesn't work. It's like I'm two people, and one of them is watching me all the time. I get so goddamn mad at myself that I could kill myself. And in a way, that's what I do every time I have an orgasm. For 1 second, like, I obliterate myself. There's not even one me, then. There's nothing. Not even the cunt. It's like receiving communion. Honest, I mean that. For a few seconds afterwards, I have a fine spiritual glow. And maybe it would continue that way indefinitely. How can you tell? If it weren't for the fact that there's a woman beside you, and then the douchebag and the water running. All those little details that make you desperately self-conscious, desperately lonely. And for that one moment of freedom, you have to listen to all that love crap. It drives me nuts sometimes. I want to kick them out immediately. I do now and then. But that doesn't keep them away. They like it, in fact. The less you notice them, the more they chase after you. There's something perverse about women. They're all masochists at heart. But what is it you want of a woman, then? I demand. He begins to mold his hands. His lower lip droops. He looks completely frustrated. When eventually he succeeds in stammering out a few broken phrases, it's with the conviction that behind his words lies an overwhelming futility. I want to be able to surrender myself to a woman, he blurts out. I want her to take me out of myself. But to do that, she's got to be better than I am. She's got to have a mind, not just a cunt. She's got to make me believe that I need her, that I can't live without her. Find me a cunt like that, will you? If you could do that, I'd give you my job. I wouldn't care then what happened to me. I wouldn't need a job or friends or books or anything. If she could only make me believe that there was something more important on earth than myself. Jesus, I hate myself. But I hate these bastardly cunts even more, because they're none of them any good. You think I like myself, he continues. That shows how little you know about me. I know I'm a great guy. I wouldn't have these problems if there weren't something to me. But what eats me up is that I can't express myself. People think I'm a cunt chaser. That's how shallow they are, these highbrows who sit on the terrace all day chewing the psychologic cud. That's not so bad, eh? Psychologic cud? Write it down for me. I'll use it in my column next week. By the way, did you ever read Steckel? Is he any good? It looks like nothing but case histories to me. I wish to Christ I could get up enough nerve to visit an analyst. A good one, I mean. I don't want to see these little shysters with goatees and frock coats, like your friend Boris. How do you manage to tolerate those guys? Don't they bore you stiff? You talk to anybody, I notice. You don't give a goddamn. Maybe you're right. I wish I weren't so damn critical. But these dirty little Jews who hang around the dome, Jesus, they give me the creeps. They sound just like textbooks. If I could talk to you every day, maybe I could get things off my chest. You're a good listener. I know you don't give a damn about me, but you're patient, and you don't have any theories to exploit. I suppose you put it all down afterward in that notebook of yours. Listen, I don't mind what you say about me, but don't make me out to be a cunt chaser. It's too simple. Someday I'll write a book about myself, about my thoughts. I don't mean just a piece of introspective analysis. I mean that I'll lay myself down on the operating table, and I'll expose my whole guts, every goddamn thing. Has anybody ever done that before? What the hell are you smiling at? Does it sound naive? I'm smiling because whenever we touch on the subject of this book which he's going to write someday, things assume an incongruous aspect. He has only to say, my book, and immediately the world shrinks to the private dimensions of Van Norden and Company. The book must be absolutely original, absolutely perfect. That is why, among other things, it is impossible for him to get started on it. As soon as he gets an idea, he begins to question it. He remembers that Dostoevsky used it, or Hamsun, or somebody else. I'm not saying that I want to be better than them, but I want to be different, he explains. And so, instead of tackling his book, he reads one author after another in order to make absolutely certain that he is not going to tread on their private property. And the more he reads, the more disdainful he becomes. None of them are satisfying. None of them arrive at that degree of perfection which he has imposed on himself. And forgetting completely that he has not written as much as a chapter, he talks about them condescendingly, quite as though there existed a shelf of books bearing his name, books which everyone is familiar with, and the titles of which it is therefore superfluous to mention. Though he has never overtly lied about this fact, nevertheless it is obvious that the people whom he buttonholes in order to air his private philosophy, his criticism, and his grievances, take it for granted that behind his loose remarks there stands a solid body of work, especially the young and foolish virgins whom he lures to his room on the pretext of reading to them his poems, or on the still better pretext of asking their advice. Without the least feeling of guilt or self-consciousness, he will hand them a piece of soiled paper on which he has scribbled a few lines. The basis of a new poem, as he puts it. And with absolute seriousness, demand of them an honest expression of opinion. As they usually have nothing to give by way of comment, wholly bewildered as they are by the utter senselessness of the lines, Van Norden seizes the occasion to expound to them his view of art, a view, needless to say, which is spontaneously created to suit the event. So expert has he become in this role, that the transition from Ezra Pound's cantos to the bed is made as simply and naturally as a modulation from one key to another. In fact, if it were not made, there would be a discord, which is what happens now and then when he makes a mistake as regards those nitwits whom he refers to as pushovers. Naturally, constituted as he is, it is with reluctance that he refers to these fatal errors of judgment. But when he does bring himself to confess to an error of this kind, it is with absolute frankness. In fact, he seems to derive a perverse pleasure in dwelling upon his inaptitude. There is one woman, for example, whom he has been trying to make for almost 10 years now, first in America and finally here in Paris. It is the only person of the opposite sex with whom he has a cordial, friendly relationship. They seem not only to like each other, but to understand each other. At first, it seemed to me that if he could really make this creature, his problem might be solved. All the elements for a successful union were there, except the fundamental one. Bessie was almost as unusual in her way as himself. She had as little concern about giving herself to a man as she has about the dessert which follows the meal. Usually, she singled out the object of her choice and made the proposition herself. She was not bad-looking, nor could one say that she was good-looking either. She had a fine body, that was the chief thing, and she liked it, as they say. They were so chummy, these two, that sometimes, in order to gratify her curiosity, and also in the vain hope of inspiring her by his prowess, Van Norden would arrange to hide her in his closet during one of his seances. After it was over, Bessie would emerge from her hiding place
and they would discuss the matter casually. That is to say, with an almost total indifference to everything except technique. Technique was one of her favorite terms, at least in those discussions which I was privileged to enjoy. "What's wrong with my technique?" he would say. And Bessie would answer, "You're too crude. If you ever expect to make me, you've got to become more subtle." There was such a perfect understanding between them, as I say, that often, when I call for Van Norden at 1:30, I would find Bessie sitting on the bed, the covers thrown back, and Van Norden inviting her to stroke his penis. "Just a few silken strokes," he would say, "so as I'll have the courage to get up." Or else he would urge her to blow on it, or, failing that, he would grab hold of himself and shake it like a dinner bell, the two of them laughing fit to die. "I'll never make this bitch," he would say. "She has no respect for me. That's what I get for taking her into my confidence." And then, abruptly, he might add, "What do you make of that blonde I showed you yesterday?" Talking to Bessie, of course, and Bessie would jeer at him, telling him that he had no taste. "Ah, don't give me that line," he would say. And then, playfully, perhaps for the thousandth time, because by now it had become a standing joke between them, "Listen, Bessie, what about a quick lay? Just one little lay." "No." And when this had passed off in the usual manner, he would add in the same tone, "Well, what about him? Why didn't you give him a lay?" The whole point about Bessie was that she couldn't, or just wouldn't, regard herself as a lay. She talked about passion as if it were a brand new word. She was passionate about things, even a little thing like a lay. She had to put her soul into it. "I get passionate too sometimes," Van Norden would say. "Oh, you," says Bessie, "you're just a worn-out satyr. You don't know the meaning of passion. When you get an erection, you think you're passionate." "All right, maybe it's not passion, but you can't get passionate without having an erection. Now, that's true, isn't it?" All this about Bessie and the other women whom he drags to his rooms day in and out occupies my thoughts as we walk to the restaurant. I have adjusted myself so well to his monologues that without interrupting my own reveries, I make whatever comment is required automatically the moment I hear his voice die out. It is a duet, and like most duets, moreover, in that one listens attentively only for the signal which announces the advent of one's own voice. As it is his night off, and as I have promised to keep him company, I have already dulled myself to his queries. I know that before the evening is over, I shall be thoroughly exhausted. If I am lucky, that is, if I can worm a few francs out of him on some pretext or other, I will duck him the moment he goes to the toilet. But he knows my propensity for slipping away, and instead of being insulted, he simply provides against the possibility by guarding his sou. If I ask him for money to buy cigarettes, he insists on going with me to purchase them. He will not be left alone, not for a second. Even when he has succeeded in grabbing off a woman, even then he is terrified to be left alone with her. If it were possible, he would have me sit in the room while he puts on the performance. It would be like asking me to wait while he took a shave. On his night off, Van Norden generally manages to have at least 50 francs in his pocket, a circumstance which does not prevent him from making a touch whenever he encounters a prospect. "Hello," he says. "Give me 20 francs. I need it." He has a way of looking panic-stricken at the same time. And if he meets with a rebuff, he becomes insulting. "Well, you can buy a drink at least." And when he gets his drink, he says more graciously, "Listen, give me 5 francs then. Give me 2 francs. We go from bar to bar, looking for a little excitement, and always accumulating a few more francs. At the Coupole, we stumble into a drunk from the newspaper, one of the upstairs guys. "There's just been an accident at the office," he informs us. "One of the proofreaders fell down the elevator shaft, not expected to live." At first, Van Norden is shocked, deeply shocked. But when he learns that it was Peckover, the Englishman, he looks relieved. "That poor bastard," he says. "He's better off dead than alive. He just got his false teeth the other day, too." The allusion to the false teeth moves the man upstairs to tears. He relates in a slobbery way a little incident connected with the accident. He is upset about it. More upset about this little incident than about the catastrophe itself. It seems that Peckover, when he hit the bottom of the shaft, regained consciousness before anyone could reach him. Despite the fact that his legs were broken and his ribs busted, he had managed to rise to all fours and grope about for his false teeth. In the ambulance, he was crying out in his delirium for the teeth he had lost. The incident was pathetic and ludicrous at the same time. The guy from upstairs hardly knew whether to laugh or to weep as he related it. It was a delicate moment, because with a drunk like that, one false move and he'd crash a bottle over your skull. He had never been particularly friendly with Peckover. As a matter of fact, he had scarcely ever set foot in the proofreading department. There was an invisible wall, like, between the guys upstairs and the guys down below. But now, since he had felt the touch of death, he wanted to display his comradeship. He wanted to weep, if possible, to show that he was a regular guy. And Joe and I, who knew Peckover well, and who knew also that he wasn't worth a good goddamn, even a few tears, we felt annoyed with this drunken sentimentality. We wanted to tell him so, too. But with a guy like that, you can't afford to be honest. You have to buy a wreath and go to the funeral and pretend that you're miserable. And you have to congratulate him, too, for the delicate obituary he's written. He'll be carrying his delicate little obituary around with him for months, praising the shit out of himself for the way he handled it.